So, it is Tuesday at 5 o'clock, and you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And before we begin office hour, I want to remind you that the views that are reflected in the show, these views, they may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. Now that I've made that disclaimer, I can move on to welcome you to office hour, 5 o'clock on Tuesdays. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And as always, I'm very psyched to go around the university and knock on doors, part of our public affairs shows here on KDVS, where every week I knock on a different door and we find out in this huge campus here, where there are many buildings I've never actually been in yet, even after teaching here for 25 years now, we find out, what are all these people doing? What are they studying? What are they thinking about? What kind of research are they doing? So today I'm quite pleased that we're doing a slightly different kind of show. Sometimes the doors that we would knock on campus are not necessarily just faculty or student doors. It's a big place, UC Davis, and lots of different people work here, and there's lots of different kinds of offices. So today, can you hear me knocking? Here I'm going. I'm knocking on the door, and I'm going over to something I suspect many of us don't really understand very well, but are intrigued, and we know it's important, which is the Office of Government Relations at Davis. And we're going to be talking today about all kinds of practical and intellectual questions about the relationship between the university and the government with Brandon Minto, who is the official director of the Federal Government Relations. So welcome to the show, Brandon.
Well, thank you, Naomi, for having me. How are you doing today?
Yeah. So as always, before we start to talk about particular issues that he encounters in his life at UC Davis, we always are interested in how people end up where they end up. How do people end up in the careers and the areas of interest? Where do they find their way? And I always think about my students who are looking around and looking for paths. So we're going to start off by asking Brandon, how did you end up as director of federal government relations at UC Davis? Okay, so give us the long is the long, the short, whatever version you want to start us off with here.
Well, it really is my dream job. And I actually am an Aggie. I went to school here. I studied history with a mini minor in political science and grew a lot and grew up here in Davis. I'm from California, Northern California, so it's kind of in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to be a high school history teacher, actually. And when I was graduating, it's when the California budget was in total disarray and they had furlough Fridays and everything was getting cut, and all my friends who had become teachers were getting pink slips, not knowing whether or not they would have the tenure, the budget would come through to keep their job. And meanwhile, they're thinking about starting a family, getting a house, you know, getting responsibilities with a car payment, so on. And so, okay, we're not going to do that. So,
yes, I remember those days, and I remember that everybody, it was like getting closer and closer. It was like a game of chicken. It got closer and closer to school, and you didn't know if you had a job, and the school didn't know if it was going to open.
Oh, it was so stressful, and just watching my friends go through it, and knew that wasn't the right time to go down that career pathway. And so not knowing what else to do with myself, I actually got an internship in the office of the lieutenant governor at that time. And John Garamendi was lieutenant governor, and one thing led to another, and I ended up getting hired onto his staff, and I was actually his body guy, is what they called it. And so my job was to be the traveling staff with the lieutenant governor, and he would travel up and down the state and have meetings all day with various different groups and entities, and I would be the staff person who would be with him in the car as he's driving to and from those meetings. And so from Monterey was the southern tip all the way to Northern California, the very tip was kind of my turf, and anything below that he would fly down to Southern California and somebody from the LA office would be with him.
So what was that like? I'm curious. That's something that most of us are not going to do in our life.
It was a fascinating learning experience. And so I got to hear all the conversations that then Lieutenant Governor Garamendi, now he's a member of Congress, was having, and hear all the different interest groups who would meet with him and present their case and their piece of the puzzle, their slice of the pie, so to speak. And it really enabled me to get a big picture vision of just how all the different interests kind of started to fit together up and down the state. And it was really helpful to hear just the way he thought about the different problems and interacting with those entities. And my job would be to take notes at the meetings, handle the follow-ups and thank you letters, and also be a kind of liaison between him and the office. And so oftentimes something would come up in the main office and they would need to get it to the lieutenant governor. So like one example, he had a radio interview that was at the last minute scheduled. And he was down, we were in Monterey, and he was touring the Monterey Bay Aquarium talking about some marine biology issues and ocean, clean ocean issues at the time. And so I get the email, you know, he has this interview scheduled in the next 20 minutes. He needs to call in at this time. And so my job is to essentially interrupt his meeting, his discussion, and pull him away. And, you know, you have this interview. And so I was, would say I'd try and be the picker of the opportune moment and try and just read that conversation, read that room, and find the right time to interject. And, you know, excuse me, I'm so sorry. There's been a slight change in the schedule, sir. You need to make a quick phone call.
We certainly read a lot in the news these days about, with the whole rise of the indivisible movement, about going to the offices of legislators and talking to them. And we see a lot of stuff on YouTube and things that have been filmed of, I would say, quite contentious discussions, town halls in which people are arguing back and forth and holding up signs. And maybe
it can be.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this wasn't going on as much in the old days when you were.
Well, you know, it's funny. So I started, with him in Lieutenant Governor's office. Then I was hired onto his staff, and then he ended up running for Congress in 2009 to replace Congresswoman Tauscher, because she had been selected by President Obama to be the Undersecretary of Defense, and so that seat was vacant. So he ran and won, and one of the first votes he took upon entering Congress, it actually might have been his first vote, was the Affordable Care Act. And so there were a lot of town halls surrounding that topic, and it was really contentious. We had a lot of people come out, and, you know, the Tea Party was in full swing at that point in time, and we had some very, very lively and interesting town halls. But I'll tell you what, to his credit, John Garamendi, I will never forget it. There were all these protesters out front. They had their signs, and he walked up, and he shook every single one of their hands and thanked them for coming, and they all kind of, well, that was interesting, didn't really expect that. Then he had this whole Make It in America agenda that he was talking about at the time, and essentially was, you know, if we're going to use American taxpayer dollars, we should spend it in America to promote our economy. And so he's talking about this, and all these Tea Partiers here were just so adamantly against the Affordable Care Act, started looking around the room at one another and kind of like, I like that. Would you support that? Mm-hmm. It was a really interesting experience.
So you had the experience of working with a seasoned and obviously successful, since he won, and he's, you know, kind of politician. After a while, I imagine you sitting there listening to this, you probably had a pretty good sense after a while when people sat down from the table across from him and started to speak. You might have had a good sense of whether they were going towards a successful. I don't know if you would wave at them to say, no, no, don't do it that way, or you would have a secret way of sort of saying that what you saw that looked, who looked like they were going to be successful when they come to that kind of a meeting, and who looked like they just weren't really going to be able to make their case. Did you sort of get a sense of that?
You know, that's definitely one of the things that I bring to table in this job, is having been on the other side. So I was the congressman's district director before taking this position at UC Davis. You're constantly taking meetings with constituents up and down the district, you know, in all walks of life. And they're talking about their particular issue, and you know, it's really, really important to them. And when you're going through that and you see all of those people presenting their cases, you really get an idea of kind of, hey, this worked, this was effective, this swayed my opinion, this didn't really. And I think there's a lot of experience that can be gained from having gone through that, and just, you know, what worked on me, what resonated with me. And when you see a lot of people come in and talk about their particular program, it gives you a little bit of a different perspective.
So maybe we often find that I'm quite struck by the number of times that people go on education abroad and they have a life-changing experience there. And one of the other life-changing experience for someone like you, who comes from the history department, is a very well-regarded department. You come out with a good degree, but you're not quite sure where to go, is a push for internships. And that's a good way for people to get a taste of a different life.
I'm a big believer. It worked out perfectly for me. And I think the thing with an internship is you get that experience, but at the same time, you're able to show your ability to work in an office, to show how you can coexist with a different staff. And a lot of times, entities will hire from the intern pool simply because they have demonstrated that ability to get along and work within that bigger group. And there is something to be said for that, to be sure.
Right. So then you're working along, and the job opens up at Davis. And you kind of, it's a big change, I imagine, working in the kind of role you had there from becoming an advocate to the University of California. What was so appealing to you about moving to this advocacy position?
So I think anybody who's been following current events recently can attest that politics can be rather frustrating. And, you know, I worked for the congressman for 8 years, and I gave it my heart and soul, and really felt like I was doing good work and wanted to do something good and of value. But it's just most congressional staff don't have a long shelf life. You're often overworked and underpaid. In the instance of somebody in the district, there's a lot of night and weekend events because you have to represent the member when they're back in D.C., which they frequently are for votes. And so say it's the Rotary Firefighter of the Year banquet or a particular graduation ceremony. You know, the member of Congress gets a lot of invitations to go to different events and perhaps say some words, present a commendation, and that would then fall to staff to take that responsibility when he's gone. And so after 8 years of not having, you know, many Friday and Saturday nights and just, you know, a lot of different events, and then the two-year election cycle, I mean, Congressman Garamendi has a relatively safe seat, but there's that election every 2 years and all that goes with it. I remember one time there was this ad that was being ran that essentially said John Garamendi was working to bring, you know, a million illegal aliens in to take jobs in California, and it's completely not true, not based in any sort of fact whatsoever. And you could tell when that ad would run because the phones would just blow up and, you know, ringing off the hook in the office, and it actually had my office's phone number, you know, call and say that this is wrong. And
so you were the poor person who had to answer the phone.
Correct. It's not funny. You're like, hey, you know, he doesn't, he's not trying to do that. He doesn't believe in that.
Well, I think you make a very important point, actually. And I think it's worth pausing to just think about that, because I have called offices as well recently. And we all know that there's a lot of calling going on. And I do think that it's quite hard to work in those jobs right now. And that really is a difficult situation, to think about the fact that even those of us who do believe in facts and don't want to yell at people on the phone, I still often think about the staff time that goes into feeling just frustrated in the way that you felt, that it's just very, very frustrating.
Well, it's hard when it's, you know, a complete lie and you want to, hey, this isn't true, kind of thing. But I mean, I say lovey, I guess. It is
what
it is.
That's part of the life of there. So you say that, so that's the other thing we're learning, that a short shelf life for those kinds of jobs, because there's only so many times that you can answer the phone and talk to a person on that. I'm sure that's totally true. So then now we switched over to taking a job at Davis. And frankly, I don't think a lot of people know very much about, I think they understand when I say I'm interviewing a chemist, or I'm interviewing someone from Comp Lit. I mean, I think people have a sense that they're departments and that's what the university does. And I think people are aware that there are these other kinds of offices around campus. But I was quite struck when I was, you know, researching this and looking at, you have a fairly large number of staff members involved. So it takes, where a lot of people are trying to advocate for Davis. So I think the first thing to do is just to explain to our listeners what is government relations and community. It's all together, right? Community.
It is, yeah. So it's government and community relations, GCR, as we fondly call it. And we are a unit in the Office of the Chancellor, and our job is to liaison and advocate for UC Davis on the local, state, and federal level. Mm-hmm. So it's really important, you know, in the local level, that we're a good neighbor, that we're engaging with the community, the city and the county, things like our long range development plan, you know, very important to the city of Davis, and rightfully so. And so part of our team works very closely on that, making sure that they're closely engaging, working with the local community, the city council, the city of Davis, the county of Yolo, to, you know, make sure their needs are heard and met, and that we're sensitive to, you know, being a good neighbor in that dynamic.
Mm-hmm. And then, well, that's not your area of expertise.
That's not, no.
So we'll come back to that. I'm sure there's a lot of people have a lot of thoughts about that, because obviously the town-gown relations are important. And then there are people who also work on the state level more.
Correct. Yeah. So we have a director of state government relations, my colleague Adrian Lopez, and he, similar to me, does my job just for the state of California. And that's real important. The state is the primary, you know, budgetary source for the university. They provide a lot of funding, a lot of direction. They have oversight over the university. And so it's really important that we are able to closely engage with the state, answer any questions that they have. Some of the interesting things that Adrian actually does, one project he's working on right now is they're actually trying to get a bill passed in the state of California. And interestingly enough, we had a researcher who was interested in soil and was taking soil samples from various parts of the state. And one of the soil samples that that researcher collected was from a state park, and they were able to actually do some magic with that, some scientific magic with that soil sample, and extract out of it some really cool uses that they want to be able to commercialize. And so, and this is not my bailiwick, I haven't been working on this, so I apologize, but they're able to have an organic pesticide for a certain kind of tree that can prevent, mm-hmm. you know, bad things from growing. It's uses like that. So it's very good for the environment, very organic, but there's this antiquated law in the books that basically says nothing can be commercialized out of a state park.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working with the legislature, I say where it's Adrian is working with the legislature to try and get a carve out, a very specific carve out for research like that, where you can take a soil sample and extrapolate a certain microbe that you can then have mm-hmm. a lot of beneficial uses for.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember over the years here, I'm quite struck, and I realize this is not your ever expertise, but before we move on, that there's a kind of erratic attention that's paid to the university at the state level, that somebody sort of wakes up one morning and tries to put a bill together. And I always find it quite amazing the way in which sort of randomized topics, or the worst thing, somebody's child came who was, came and had something happen to them. Suddenly there's a state bill because that person's parent was a state legislator or something like that.
It has been known to happen. So I heard a story of an outgoing legislator who was very fond of a UC and wanted to do a bill that would benefit the campus. And the way it works is, not one individual UC can just originate a bill. There's a process with the entire system and OP and the regents, and you get approval for what they're going to push forward and support. And there wasn't an appetite for that particular piece of legislation. And so, the person conveyed it back to the office. And, oh, thank you so much. We appreciate it. But this really isn't necessary right now. Well, the office wanted to continue with it and push forward. And so they're pushing that bill. And then, OP is going to the state government relations person like, hey, what's up? Why are they pushing this bill? And he says, I told them, thank you, no thanks, but I can't control what they do. So no. It's kind of one of those funny things.
Yeah, well, not everybody has the same view. And also, I'm sure that, again, that this is not something we'll go into in detail in this show, but I think it's important for a future show, is that the continuing decrease of support from the state is obviously the background against which all of this happens with, that. And so that's, I'm sure, must be a big issue in your office.
It's definitely a big challenge, and certainly budget is one of the top advocacy issues in our office, both for Adrian at the state level, for me at the federal level. We do almost $500 million in federally funded research,
mm-hmm.
And it's really, really important to the UC Davis apparatus to be an R1, a research-intensive university, one of the leading researchers across the nation. And so it's important that we're talking to the legislators, to the decision makers on those budgets about the value of those investments and what is being done with that research investment and what comes out of it. And frankly, why does it matter? Why should they care?
Mm-hmm.
And really try and make the case that there's value in that investment and it needs to continue.
Yeah.
And not just the value in the investment, but some of those investments just aren't going to happen otherwise. And so that's also part of the story that we have to tell and connect and, make sure that they understand, hey, look, this is really important and it's not going to happen without the government's leadership making that investment.
That there's some things that cannot be replaced by just
correct.
Swapping or around just the funder.
Some basic research, you don't necessarily know what you're going to glean out of it,
yes.
What great discovery is going to come, but there's just not an appetite within industry to invest in certain basic research that is fundamental and paramount that many important discoveries have been built off of.
Sure. Okay, well, let's go then to your area of expertise, which is a frightening thought that your area of expertise would be the federal government. It's a very frightening thought right now.
If anybody could be called an expert on that.
Right. I don't even know what that means. Maybe there's no such thing as it right now as being an expert on the federal government. So what kinds of things do you specifically do in your day-to-day life here on campus?
So my job is to help enhance the UC Davis brand at the federal government. And whatever goes into that. And so we want a message about what we're doing. We want to connect faculty and students to decision makers, to members of Congress. We want to inform policy and make sure that educated decisions are being made. We advocate for those robust research accounts. I mean, that's really, really, really important that the federal government is investing in NIH and NSF and USDA AFRI. That's the Agricultural and Food Research Initiative, and things of that sort. And so, anything happening at the federal government that is going to impact UC Davis higher education, then hopefully we're aware of and paying attention to, and making sure that we're weighing in about how it would affect the university, how it would affect our faculty, our students, and make sure that they're hopefully considering that when they're going about making those decisions that they have to make.
So, and this, presumably you do this in conjunction with the other campuses.
Correct. And so each one of the 10 campuses has a representative like myself whose primary job is that campus. And really it's to kind of tell the story through that campus's perspective and to connect with the most local members of that campus who are going to be most sensitive to that campus. And then we work in conjunction with the entire system. They have a team back in Washington, D.C. that helps set and administer the advocacy agenda. Mm-hmm. So we work closely with the Office of the President and so on and so forth. And so it's not the type of situation to where anyone you see, against the Office of the President can go rogue, so to speak, and say, hey, we want to do this, when that's not.
UC Santa Cruz is particularly interested in federal legislation on something, to do with their banana slugs, aren't they?
Exactly. And so, we want to speak with one voice. It's the whole theory line of thought that if everybody is speaking at the same time, saying something different, you can't make any sense out of it. But if everybody speaks together saying the same thing, then it's going to resonate really loudly.
Okay, so explain it from the point of view of, for our listeners, who in your office decides what you're going to do? Again, as you say, coordination must be central to this.
Yeah, so we work closely with the Office of the President. So they have a director of the federal government office back there, president, actually. His name's Chris Harrington. And so he's largely calling the shots, and we're going to make sure that we have OP approval for anything that we do. But that's not to say that UC Davis can't elevate any particular priority. And so certainly each one of the different campuses has unique strengths, different things that they want to expound upon, explore, and do. And so there's obviously going to be some variance there, but we want to make sure that we're, collectively pulling on the rope as best we can to the extent possible. And certain issues, like DACA, for example,
right.
Not one individual campus is going to come out and say, no, we don't support DACA.
Well, I think for our listeners, this is a particularly interesting time to have this show and to have you on. One of the reasons is that you and I have been talking over many months over last year about very concrete issues, which may not be totally related to this, but do relate with the idea of getting students more involved in voting, for example, because you are in government relations and that's important. But it also really strikes me that the university is really making a lot of stands now it's coming out. The leadership is taking positions, which are not always the positions that are the positions of the federal government. So we're at a particularly interesting moment in terms of government relations, because I imagine that it's somewhat fraught with Janet Napolitano, things like DACA, which have the university's really been, on the forefront of standing up for DACA.
Yeah, the university typically doesn't weigh in on a whole lot of legislation. I mean, we put forward our budget priorities, certainly, and we'll talk about the higher education reauthorization or other things that have a very tangible impact. But we mostly are working more behind the scenes, so to speak, and talking to the various offices about how it's going to impact or engage the university. And so it's not so often that we're really out front on an issue, but DACA is definitely one of them. I mean, it's really important. In the state of California, if you just look at our demographics, if you look at the makeup of the state, for President Napolitano, especially so too, given her history in the Department of Homeland Security and her role in crafting that program, it's definitely something that's a top priority for the UC system.
So, as you as sort of on the day to day in the bench in the trenches, how does it feel to be sort of pushing, things like this, like DACA, in a time when there's a lot of opposition to DACA you know, what does it feel like? You're out there fighting this fight, which I'd like to think we also do for moral reasons as well. We believe it is the correct policy, but it's not an easy time. You don't just, you know, palsy around with people in the federal government. You're actually in opposition to them in some ways.
Yeah, so we are fortunate in California. We have a lot of great representation, especially here locally around UC Davis. And so for me on that issue with, you know, Congressman Garamendi, Congresswoman Matsui, Congressman Barra, Congressman Thompson, both of our senators, Feinstein and Harris, I mean, it really is, like, for lack of a better term, preaching to the choir. They're there on that issue. They've been out front on it from day one. They're fully supportive. They understand that those students are part of the university family, that, you know, these are by and large, you know, young people who have lived in California the majority of their lives. I mean, they, mm-hmm. they, you know, they're part of the California family, to be sure. And so it's a pretty sympathetic ear for a lot of our delegation in engaging on these issues. And, there's pluses and minuses with that though, because I will say that I often feel like I'm not necessarily moving the needle on that issue, because, if you just look at the political map, and, you know, look at California, I mean, especially after the recent election, it's a very, very blue state. And the way it works, there's a saying, all politics are local. And there really is something to be said for that. And so, you know, the member of Congress who represents a particular district of 650,000 people in Florida, they aren't necessarily so concerned about what UC Davis has to say about an issue. So there is a little bit of a geographic divide there. And that's something that we have to overcome and work around. And so we're often trying to find strategies to do just that. And so looking at ways that we can connect with people who are outside of our geographic proximity, looking at, you know, other institutions of higher education that maybe are in their district that we can partner with on a particular issue and have them be the point in engaging that member of Congress. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes a really important part of the work that we do. We're actually part of a couple higher education associations. So the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities, and mm-hmm. then also AAU, which is the American Association of Universities, I believe. And those are really helpful because it's comprised of schools, you know, across all 50 states, across all types of political district that the school might reside in or maybe be nearby or maybe, you know, a particular member of Congress is an alum of a certain school. And so those are various connection points that you can, you know, use to hopefully get your foot in the door, have a seat in the table and try and get your opinion heard.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to come back to this because I think that this question of how does the university advocate for something like DACA is a really good example for us to think about what this, what your Office of Federal Government Relations does. But we've actually come to the end of our first segment of Office Hour today. So we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back with Brandon Minto and talk some more about you know, what the UC does when it's going and knocking on other people's doors for a change instead of us just knocking on doors here. So stay with us. So we are back again. This is the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And we've knocked on the door of the Government Relations Office here at UC Davis. And we're talking with Brandon Minto about how the UC engages in advocacy. And I'm quite interested in the details of the case on DACA, and we're going to talk a little bit more about DACA. This isn't the only thing that the UC is advocating about, but I think it's an interesting example. And, of course, it seems like it parallels some of what you did before, which is watching and listening to people advocating for things and trying to figure out what works.
How can you move the needle?
How can you move the needle? So you were saying that now you feel like it's hard to move the needle because the needle is already with our legislators. They're already big supporters of DACA. So what then is the next thing? What is your office then do if you have the support you have there? So you're not talking about getting groups of students to go to try to get, you know, local support for DACA. What kinds of things can your office do?
Yeah, well, some of the tangible actions we've taken, we actually did two phone banks here on campus with students. We partnered with Student Affairs. We provided pizza to students if they were willing to do some civic participation and engage, and we encouraged them to call their member of Congress to talk about that issue and what it meant to them. There's actually, put a little plug in here, a website. There's the University of California Advocacy Network, UCAN. And if you just Google University of California, UCAN, you'll get it. It'll be like the top Google hit. And it's something that all students and faculty can sign up for, and it's coordinated centrally through the University of California, and there's various different advocacy opportunities and topics that come up, mm-hmm. and you can be a UCAN ambassador. Mm-hmm. So it was through that program that we actually did the phone banking and encouraged students to call their local members of Congress. We set up a couple laptops and had a kind of script on hand for them to be able to speak to if they so desired.
So this was student volunteers?
Correct. So we worked with the AB 540 Center, with Centro, got some volunteers, and we kind of tried to broadcast the message. And yeah, we did some phone banks on the issue.
Okay. So even though you're not primarily, just so our listeners understand, you're not primarily a part of student affairs.
No.
You're really a very different part of campus than we've really had on the show before. But you are still, when there come issues, oddly enough, what you're telling us now, you are a kind of researcher, right? Just like everybody else, because you're doing research is how do you get the federal government to support DACA, okay?
You could put it that
exactly.
way.
Exactly. So what the research you're bringing us today is that, well, like everything else, you get students on the phone. Yeah. You get people on the phone.
So we talked about how all politics are local, and at the end of the day, students are constituents too. Now, students aren't the best about voting, and that's something that we have talked about before, and that's one reason why some of those student issues are somewhat overlooked. And a lot of people talk about how seniors vote in mass, and you look at the percentages, and overwhelmingly, seniors is the voting block that turns out with most regularity. And a lot of legislators are very sensitive to issues that resonate strongly with seniors. And that's just one example of the power of the vote.
Okay, so let's just stop here. Any students out there, we are talking about you, okay? Because Brandon and I have been involved last year in a variety of activities to try to get students to vote more. And so we're officially launching today the Office Hour 2020 Drive. We've got a year to get ourselves, well, a year and a little bit more, to try to double the number of students who vote, simply to increase participation, nonpartisan, to increase participation on campus. I'm curious, before we move on, if just to pick your brain on this for a moment, do you have any insights about why students don't vote? I mean, what do you think you see from your end of the world? Because it's certainly true that people, legislators, don't are not live in fear of students, because students just tend not to advocate for their own interests.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that sometimes it's logistical challenges when you're, you know, living away from home, or you have various different addresses that you're keeping. Students move around frequently.
Yeah.
Those types of things just add a little bit of an increased burden, and you have to keep your voting roll updated and, you know, update your address, so to speak, all those types of activities. And so that extra hurdle, that step you have to take, I think that can be a deterrent. I think oftentimes young people just aren't as interested.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
that's part of it.
And informed. And I've been, and I know my students have told me they're afraid of the ballot, because the California ballot is very long and very complicated. So it's a discouraging way to start off to vote when you have something that's so complicated and you may not be able to fill it all out.
I think that's really fair, especially with the initiative process. So California is actually one of the few states that allows you to put something on the ballot, and if it gets a majority, it becomes part of the Constitution. I mean, it's really ridiculous. We actually have one of the longest constitutions, if not the longest, out of any democracy in the world, here in the state of California.
Okay, that's your random fact, trivia fact for today.
And that's because all of the ballot initiatives, and so there's been, you know, numerous every election cycle, and it becomes part of our Constitution.
So you just staple it on the end. You just get a big stapler, and you staple the new initiative on the end. Well, we're going to be talking about this on the show, and so we will come back to the question of student voting. So to go back to DACA, what other things besides having a phone bank, which is just a, you know, your research shows what a lot of other research shows, which is that when people hear on the phone from their people who are going to vote for them, that they pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So that does seem to be something that's really repeated over and over again in sort of how-to manuals. What other kinds of things can the UC do besides the phone calling?
So we've done a handful of profiles, and so we actually worked to identify some of our stellar DACA students and essentially worked with them with their permission to tell their story. We crafted it in such a way so that it could be read on the floor of Congress, on the floor of the House, and shared them with our legislators, essentially talking about these individuals, you know, somebody who comes from the Central Valley who wants to go to medical school so that they can go back and be a doctor in an area that has a serious need and shortage on doctors. Those types of stories are really powerful, and I think it helps to break down some of the stereotypes and really, you know, just show, hey, these are people who are from the California family who, you know, are from our community, who live with and amongst us, and there's nothing to be, you know, afraid of.
Well, I think that actually jibes very much with what I have heard about sort of a political advocacy in general, which is that one story is the way to go, you know, that one story well told is the way to advocate for a whole group of people, and that people can't think about people in groups, but they can think about one story. That's Nicholas Kristof's push about, do you start with one story? And that if you try to even tell, you know, too many stories, people get confused on that. So let's look at, because we don't have endless amounts of time, what can you give us an example of another advocacy issue? We all, I think everybody understands DACA who lives in California and listens to the radio. What, I mean, the federal government must do a lot more than just DACA.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, one of the ones that I'm most proud about recently was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. And that sounds really strange, right? Because that bill is not good for California.
Yeah.
And but let me tell you what, the final version of the bill was a lot better for our students than the initial versions of that bill. And that's what I'm particularly proud of. And so initially that bill, they did a lot of things that were really bad for students in the first version of that bill. And so a couple ones in particular, so they wanted to eliminate the student loan interest deduction. And so if you went to the UC Davis Medical School, you graduated with somewhere around $150,000 of debt on average.
Mm-hmm.
That student loan interest deduction on that debt, that's pretty important.
Yeah.
I have some other stats here. Let me see here. Things like the qualified tuition assistance. And so if you're a TA and you're teaching and you're getting paid for some of that teaching and it goes against the cost of your education. So we calculated that for the 2015 and 16 academic school year, we had 6,734 graduate students received $60.5 million in qualified tuition expenses. And so that's something that had traditionally not been taxed, and they wanted to tax that. So that was going to be a huge extra burden on our graduate students come tax season that they were going to have to contend with. Things like the lifetime education tax credit. So there was a number of different tax credits that students could be eligible for, and the initial version of that bill rolled them all into one and put a four-year lifespan on it, which, okay, you know, 4 years, you don't necessarily think that that's so bad, but say you're an undergraduate for 4 years and you utilize that tax credit, then you want to go to graduate school. No, that tax credit no longer exists for you because it had a four-year life. So there were a number of different things like that that all were really, really bad for students and were in the initial version of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went into overdrive and we talked from amongst the UC, right, all 10 campuses, every single legislative office in the state of California, all 55 members we met with, and we went over all of the impacts. We had Chancellor May do a press conference with Congressman Matsui. We had a op-ed done in a local newspaper, all sorts of outreach on the topic. And so Congressman McClintock, he is a Republican who is in our area.
Mm-hmm. North.
Correct. Yeah, he's out of like kind of Roseville area. And obviously, being one of the few Republicans in the state, he's getting a lot of pressure from Speaker McCarthy, Leader McCarthy, who's the majority leader at the time, mm-hmm. now the minority leader. A lot of pressure to vote for that bill. And we lobbied really hard in Congressman McClintock's office on this issue, and it hasn't been the most successful time always, you know, going and meeting with that office and talking about various issues. But I'll tell you, he didn't vote for the first version of that bill, and he put out a press release and he cited a litany of reasons for why he didn't vote for it, and amongst them was impacts to students.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that all those poison pills I just discussed didn't make it into the final version of the bill. And so that's a victory amongst a defeat, I guess you could say, because, you know, the bill still really is bad for California with all the salt taxes whatnot. But, you know, at the end of the day, for our students, we fought really hard and it came out a lot better.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you were there for. You were there to advocate for the students. I'm curious just whether this was primarily done by mostly staff going to the office in these cases, or do you take, I haven't heard any faculty doing anything in any of these vignettes. I've heard you and I've heard some students. Maybe it's just hard to get faculty out of our offices onto the political streets. And I also wondered about scientists, too, because of all the attack that's going on as scientists now. But is there any role for faculty in any of these things?
Well, there most definitely is. So on the tax bill, not so much, because we were talking about just, economic impacts and going over, numbers and percentages. But many times we take faculty back and have them talk about their research. And really, that's like the number one thing that I want to have happen, because it's far more effective for a researcher or faculty to talk about what they do, why they're passionate about it, why it matters with that member of Congress to tell their story than to have me do it.
Well, does that happen and does it work? It certainly we're losing the sort of the national battle now. We saw now that we get to make up weather, we've learned this week, on top of everything else we get to make up.
Yes and no. So they are still increasing. So we've, even with the president and him putting forward some really small budgets, huge reductions, that we've seen increases in NIH, NSF, and so those
That's
big
true.
Research accounts. And so it hasn't always been a straight line of increase. It's definitely been a somewhat curvy road, ups and downs, and there are challenges to be sure. But all things considered, it could be worse.
Well, and how are we as faculty? You can say this honestly. I mean, are we any good? I'm quite struck by this sort of move in the world of science, which obviously we have a lot of STEM faculty at Davis, keep telling them, you've got to get out of your labs now. You've got to get out there and do the kinds of things you do for a living. So this is a place where sort of your office might meet more growing pressure on faculty. And faculty are not jumping at the bit to do this, as far as I can see.
So let me just say, if there's any faculty listening, especially if you do any federally funded research, come talk to me. If you're ever going back to D.C., it actually is a big part of what we do. And so we help set up congressional visits for different researchers who are going back there, and we'll try and be strategic. Oftentimes, we want to make sure our local delegation's informed, but it doesn't end there. And so we'll look at various committee assignments and, what is it, that niche that faculty researcher is involved in, that they're looking at? Okay, who does that connect with? Who is going to be interested and impacted by that? And we try and, broaden as big of a net as we can to get awareness and hopefully support around that issue. And it really is one of the most important activities that we can be engaging in. I think it's important to remember the opportunity cost of the decisions that these members of Congress, these legislators, are faced with every day. And every day they're having people come by their office, come and talk to them about their particular federally funded program and why it's so important and what it does and who it employs and how it moves the needle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important for us to remember that. And so for every one thing that they fund, there's one thing that they can't fund.
Right.
And the old adage, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. I mean, there is a certain, nugget of truth in that. And it's important to maintain a presence, to have that relationship, to know that, if there's a particular committee hearing on a topic, that, hey, UC Davis can be a resource, and we can get, if we call them, a great person to come and testify on this topic. We actually had one recently, Dr. Cass in the provost's office. He's the vice provost. He went and testified before the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology on sexual harassment issues in science and combating them. And
not really his area of research per se.
He has been the lead. We have this pilot program on campus.
Yes.
And so it sounds like you're aware of it. It's really, really neat. In going through this, learned a lot about it. And so he went and testified about that pilot program as an action that can be taken to try and combat, a culture of sexual harassment. And I think that that's especially important for UC Davis to be a leader in. If you look at our demographics, we're 59% female undergrad. We are ranked by Forbes as the number one college for women in STEM. In 2012, we actually received a big grant from the NSF. It was an institutional transformational grant that's purpose was to try and have, policies, procedures put in place to fundamentally transform our institution to better promote women in STEM. Mm-hmm. So there's a really neat story happening here on that front. And I thought it was super exciting and relevant that we were able to be on record with our pilot program and this committee talking about some proactive steps that can be taken.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how willing you are to, speak brutally honestly about this, but because you've worked in two tough situations, And I think many of us on the campus are somewhat engaged in some kind of relations with the government in some form or another. And you've both worked on the inside in a way as an aide there, and now you're advocating for the university. So based on your life of research here, you know, what really would you encourage students or just listeners to think about in terms of we want to move the needle? I mean, one reason why I don't do more of this is because it's very frustrating, and I have a lot of other things to do as a faculty member, and I'm sure every listener is running through their head that everybody has a lot on their plate right now. And the idea of going out and trying to advocate for change or advocate for science or advocating for fact or advocating for DACA or for getting rid of sexual harassment. And I mean, there's a lot of issues. What pearls of wisdom will you can you give us how to do that without getting just simply too discouraged, as you say, or, just feeling that we don't really know what we're doing. We're wasting our time.
Yeah, so first and foremost, come talk to us. We have an open door policy. Our number is 530-752-9795, and we're here to help. We want to be a resource. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to know that you can engage and that really it can have an impact. And sometimes it's frustrating, certainly feels like banging your head against the wall. And certain issues, too, are just especially complicated and
like
challenging.
What?
Like DACA. And so at the end of the day, it's not going to be resolved until there's a broader immigration agreement made. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of held up in the auspices of that discussion. And really, if you just look at the political landscape, that it may not be resolved until the next election. Then even then, pending what happens with the next election, if it's still a split Congress like we currently have, then there's going to have to be some sort of compromise in some way, shape, or form. For something's going to have to give. Otherwise, the status quo that we've unfortunately been enduring is going to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And so, on an issue like that, I mean, it really, it's a handful of people ultimately are really holding that up and are going to work it out. And I mean, it's like Speaker Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, and the president.
Mm-hmm.
And until there's some sort of more clarity through the election, or there's some sort of willingness to compromise on something, I mean, just politically, that's the reality.
Okay, so here we're starting our how-to guide by saying, first of all, look at your issue and see if it's a doable issue. Though my father always felt that everybody should have one cause that was not doable, that they worked on anyway, that one should have a sort of utopian cause as well, but that part of it might be in order not to get too frustrated, to just simply try to find something that can be moved forward.
Okay, and I mean, I want to, characterize that because I, it's important to engage, and I don't want to lose sight of that. And so, even on something that's a really complicated issue like DACA, I mean, I don't mean to say that you should just raise your hands, give up, and not continue to engage. And so, I think that we need to continue to speak with our friends, family, colleagues, and educate them on the value of what's going on, and continue to talk to our legislators and let them know that as a constituent, this is what's important for me. And there are certain guidelines too in terms of how you can advocate as an official representative of UC, and that is something to consider. And you can find those guidelines through our website, gcr.ucdavis.edu. So I encourage you to check that out. And it's essentially, if you're doing it in an official capacity, then there are some restrictions in terms of how and what you can do.
Right.
If you're doing it as an individual, as a citizen, you do whatever you want.
Okay. So what do you think, down and dirty, is the most effective way? Are we talking about, and I realize it's never going to be a one-size-fits-all issues, but I'm hearing a lot about individual connections between voters and the people who represent them. And I wonder, I'm going to ask my students the first day of class, which is coming up, how many of them know who represents them at different...
That's an important starting point.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to know who's representing you. But that we're still in a world, despite all the things that have changed, it's not that different than when I was little, many, many years ago, and we used to go and visit. I remember that very well, growing up in Chicago, and then going with my father, we would go to different legislative offices and we would talk to people about issues, and that still basically is, I mean, I feel sort of nostalgic when I talk like that. But you're telling me that that actually is how what advocacy, the most effective advocacy today?
Yeah. At the end of the day, you're going to love this. Go vote. And if they don't do what you want or they're making decisions that you don't like, vote them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it sounds simple, right? And I think that it largely comes down to that. And so it's important that you're engaging, that you're making your opinion heard. And I think it's also needs to be realized that, you know, you may not agree, see eye to eye with everybody on everything. I mean, that's hard to find in life. And so, you know, look at their approach. How are they thinking about it? How are they going about making their decision? And so maybe you won't agree at the end of the day with the decision, but if you can respect and appreciate the approach, then there can be something there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, vote and don't be afraid to share your opinion.
Mm-hmm. Voting. Okay. So, and if you saw somebody coming in to do advocacy in person, we've already talked about the importance of phone calls and voting. If you, what would all your experiences with now both sides of the table and then, you know, what makes a good person who's coming in and advocating for DACA or whatever it is, what, when they, you sit down at that table and you hear them, you know, what are the scales that you're judging them on?
So we coach all of our researchers who are going to go back, who are going to be meeting with a member of Congress and help them talk about their research, help them refine their talking
points. So clarity on clarity.
So it's important. What you want to make sure that they're doing is I always say kind of distill it down to the most common denominator and don't just say like, clean oceans are good. And so my research is good because it ends with clean oceans. And so you're leaving a lot on the table if you just leave it at that. And why are clean oceans good? You can connect it to tourism industries. You can connect it to fishery industries. You can connect it to a lot of different things that are benefited or impacted from a clean ocean. So it behooves you to kind of make that part of your story and really help connect your particular issue to the other things that it touches, because it's going to have an impact on those other things. And you're selling that issue short if you don't talk about the totality of the impacts. And that's one of the biggest messages that we share with our research, because oftentimes, I mean, they're so smart and laser focused on a particular issue that maybe they're not necessarily describing how that issue fits into the bigger picture. And to the extent that you can do that, you can really make it a lot more clear and impactful.
Tell a good story. Yeah. And tell a good story about one thing or one person.
And then I always say too, don't try to not hang your hat on it's the right thing to do. And the reason I say that is because there's a big opportunity cost, like I said, for every decision they make. So there's a lot of tough decisions that they have to make. And so if you just think in your personal life, you know, when budgets are tight and there's tough decisions, sometimes, you know, things that feel good, that are altruistic in nature, are some of the first that unfortunately have to go. As opposed to something that maybe you feel like, oh, this absolutely has to be done, even though it doesn't feel so good to do. And so I always try to encourage any time to bring it back to a self-serving argument if you can. And, you know, hey, it's good to do this. Like, this is important. But at the same time, we're still learning from this. And we're getting this important experience that's going to benefit us down the road, that's going to enable
and
us to be better.
You.
Correct. And so, like, an example that I talk about, we do a lot of work through USAID abroad. And we have 5 Feed the Future Innovation Labs here on campus. And they're all focused on various aspects of agriculture and outside of the United States. And so, you know, I need to go and talk to the members of Congress about these Feed the Future Innovation Labs and why this investment's important. And so as part of that discussion, I don't just leave it as, hey, it's important for us to go and invest in these other countries. And they were all enabled through the Global Food Security Act. And it actually talks about in that bill, it's the sense of Congress that it's in the national security interest of the United States to go make these investments. And so I think it's important to bring that part of the story in and say, like, hey, you know, we're going to spend less in aid money if we're making these investments, if we're supporting over there. And like fundamentally the science, we're making climate resilient millet that's going to require less water and be able to grow in a wider variety of drier climates. Okay.
So
the fundamental science behind that is not just restricted to millet, and we'll be able to learn, you know, the fundamental basics of what goes into that and take it here and apply it to a crop that's grown domestically. And so weaving in those types of arguments, I always find help enhance the message.
And what's the next thing? What's next on your agenda? What's the next thing you're going to be advocating about?
So the next big lift for the next month is the budget.
Yep.
And so, yeah, if they don't come up with 12 appropriations bills by September 30th, and we're looking at another shutdown, likely we'll see a continuing resolution to where they'll buy themselves more time. Mm-hmm. But the Senate has yet to pass any of the 12 appropriations bills. The House had passed 10 of the 12, but per the budgetary agreement that the president signed into law on August 2nd, there's about $15 billion less available for those bills. So they're going to have to...
So in the next couple of days, find $15 billion.
Yeah, well, hopefully not from our research programs.
Oh, hopefully not, that's for sure. Well, that was really interesting. I really have never really understood that office before, so I really appreciate it. I want to thank Brandon for coming over to Office Hour today.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, this will be archived on OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. That's OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. And there will be a link not only to this, but underneath it, there will be a link to your office so people can click on there. And he said, come and knock on his door. So I think that's our homework for this week, to go off and,
we are here to serve,
and knock on the door and make sure that those people are advocating for things that are important to you. So we'll be back next week. And in the meantime, think advocacy. Bye.